Welcome back to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer. We are listening to Holding Difficult Conversations About Race, Lessons from the Jim Crow Museum, presented by the museum's director and founder, Dr. David Pilgrim. He recently spoke at Manchester University as part of their Values, Ideas, and the Arts series. Thank you for listening.
I don't think there's a president in my lifetime, and I've lived a long time, I don't think there's a president in my lifetime who I haven't disagreed with. I start looking at people's policies, and I look at their policies. I have strong disagreements with almost every president who has ever existed. But shouldn't it be sufficient for me just to say I disagree with their policies? Shouldn't have to call them a demon, an antichrist, a traitor, a member of some defamed group. I should simply be able to say and argue my point in an intelligent way that I think they're wrong. Whether I think they're wrong or right depends on what they're saying. So we take old images and we look at ways they've morphed into the present. And again, it's not some liberal, non-thinking facility. We have engaged discussions, engaged debates. Forgive the cliche, but we believe in the triumph of dialogue. We believe it's still possible. That's why it's called higher education. So I'm going to tell you a few stories about dialoguing.
The image above Dr. Pilgrim shows a large section of counter with individual sections, almost like teller windows. The sign above them says student services.
So this right here is at a certain school. I won't tell you what school, but it's where I currently work. And that's a place where people accept money. So if you're a student, you work in that place. And I believe most students are underpaid. I saw the president. I don't know what happened to him. It's like, I know we didn't pay this guy to come here and start some crap with our students. So anyway, but you would have like, if you're like us, you would have like some full-time, 40-hour week workers, and you'd have a couple students. And so a student was like on the far end, and then the other people were like full-time workers. The student had been one of my students when I was a teacher, before I went into administration. And so every time I saw her, I would say the same thing I said to these students who I'd never met before. Like, how are you doing in class? I don't care about FERPA. You know what I mean. My point, I love FERPA's wonderful. Okay, what I'm saying is that I don't know if they felt that I was being intrusive or not, but I asked, so how are you doing in class? What are your grades? I challenge you. I'll give you $25 for every A if you give me $100 for every time you don't make an A. I travel the country, and no one ever takes me up on that, by the way. Okay? And so I'd walk by there every day, and I'd say good morning to each of the people. But to that student, what I would say would be, so how are you doing in class? Are you doing okay? Are you studying? Whatever. So one day I'm walking by, and I had been vice president for a very short time. I went from the classroom to being a vice president, that's a whole nother story. But one of the people that worked near her said to me, excuse me, you've just created a little diversity plan. Now, first of all, you can see this is not going to go great. You've just created a new diversity plan, and I've been reading your little plan. And so I want to ask you, why is it that every time you walk by here, you stop and you ask her how she's doing in class and all this other stuff, but the rest of us, you only say hello? Now, I could have just tried to explain to her that this was my former student, and maybe I did. I think I did. But I was at a crossroads there. And so I said to her, she's one of my students, why? She says, oh, I'm just being curious because it just seems like there's just something going on with you. Now, the student was an African American. The other people working there were white Americans, European Americans. Again, I have a chance there to this not to go bad. But I can be petty and immature. And so I said to her, what is it you think is going on here? Now, all of a sudden, this is going to go. You guys get the picture I'm trying to paint? Okay. So long story short, I didn't leave soon enough. And she ended up being embarrassed. And she probably stayed there another 8 years and never spoke to me as her way of punishing me. And I had done the thing that I hadn't learned yet to not do, which was what? Don't do what? Don't crush people. Even when they're doing something which is not coming from a good space, don't crush them. So a couple of the lessons. A lot of the conversations we have about race, race doesn't come up. No one makes it explicitly about race. And yet, it's about race sometimes. Sometimes it's not, but sometimes it is. Most of the conversations about race are unstructured, unplanned. So that day when I went to work, all I meant to do was say good morning to people. I did not mean to have a conversation that was going to lead to somebody not speaking to me for 8 years. I'm spoiled in conversations about race. Because of the Jim Crow Museum, most of the conversations I have about race are structured, they're formal, and quite frankly, to be honest with you, they're on my terms. They're in the museum. People are coming to the museum expecting to have a painful, sometimes difficult, most of the times, but at all times, a conversation about race. But when I'm just walking in a building, it's not planned. And then conversations about race, quite frankly, conversations about issues related to LGBT people, conversations about issues related to sexism, conversations about classism, they often end with someone trying to win the conversation. And I really thought that was going to end when I left graduate school. I mean, graduate school was like this place where you're sharpening your swords with your intellectual swords. Anybody been to graduate school? Right? And it's this banter, and sometimes it was mean-spirited, but there was always this undercurrent of who's smartest and who's going to win the argument. I was so glad to leave that crap. And now we're a culture where it's like, I don't remember the last time I heard two people in a conversation that where they were truly engaged in a conversation of differences, and one of them said to the other, you know, you might be right about that.
As Dr. Pilgrim finished this point, the picture behind him changed to show Dr. Martin Luther King marching, with arms linked with a crowd of people during the Civil Rights Movement. The quote beneath it reads, "Let no man pull you so low as to hate him."
So I threw this picture in for a couple reasons. One, I love the quote. And I'm honored, by the way, to have been invited here to the last place where Dr. King gave a talk, last college where he gave a talk. That's an honor, okay? It's also one of the pictures that we got in that collection that I told you about earlier.
The slide on screen now shows a button-down shirt that has four offensive caricatures of black men. One is carrying a boombox and making a gang sign. Two have their pants worn lower than most of their underwear, and a fourth is in the background urinating on a wall.
Second story. I bought this shirt in Mobile, went back to Mobile, had a relative pass away, went down for the funeral. It was one of the few pieces in the museum that I bought from a black person, at least knowingly. That years later, I might have bought a lot and I wouldn't know because I bought them off eBay or something. But in terms of one-on-one interactions, it was like the first one of the few times. Actually, and the guy kept saying to me, because he had a lot of them, different sizes, he kept saying, well, what size are you? And I was like, it doesn't matter. And he was like, yeah, it's going to look good on you. I was like, no, it's not going to look good on me. I'm not wearing that shirt. He was like, well, you still got to give me a size. I was like, just give me a big one. You know, just give me a big one. So I had an opportunity to do, and this is the part where I really have to be aware of the cameras. I had an opportunity to do some training with the CIA. And so went to their facility with a couple of co-facilitators. I don't think it's a secret to say that they were in Chantilly, Virginia. Probably be a knock on my door when I get home. So I get in there and I have a group of people, I don't know, 15 people or so, 20 people. And I pull out the shirt and I do the visual thinking strategies thing that we do. And I say to them, what is it you see? Just tell me what you see. I mean, I know what I see, but but I want to engage you in conversation. So what is it you see? We weren't in there a second before, and I don't like using the term N-word. I just feel like I should at this college for some reason, but it's just another way of saying the word. But that word came up. It was like, that's what they saw. And I was like, what do you mean? And we just went, they were like, yeah, because this guy is urinating on the street, and this guy has a boombox, and this guy has this funky hat on his head. And I was like, yeah, but why would that make it represent the word? And why couldn't you just say it's someone urinating? And they were yelling at me, and they got frustrated with me. And finally, one of them said to me, did you fly in? I said, of course I flew in. It was like, did you fly in through D.C.? I was like, wow. And I was like, yeah, I flew in through D.C. And they were like, then you know what we're talking about. And I'm thinking, oh, my goodness, these people work at the CIA. So race is never as simple as you think. And I'll tell you why. A couple lessons. That group of people, let's say there were 15 of them, I bet you only two of them were white. Now, not everybody, you can tell their racial self-identification by how they present. But as a person who's just looking, if I had to make a guess, I would say the other 13 were either black or biracial. And they were using that word as a marker of distinction between poor black people and themselves. And I was like, wow, do you even know that's what's happening here? And I tried to be the dispassionate, the objective sociologist just facilitating a discussion. And then toward the end, I just went all Jesse Jackson, except sincere. And I said to them, so those women and men who were beaten during the civil rights movement, and those weren't water hoses, those were pressure hoses, will pull the bark off of a tree. Were they? And I went through a list of the black folks who sacrificed all the ridicule and everything. And I said, so if they weren't, then neither of those young men. Call them something else. So a couple things came out of that. One is privilege. Man, when you say privilege, people just freak out. The fact is, I mean, I grew up poor. I'm not poor now. I have some privilege. I can walk in Sam's Club. I'm not bragging or complaining, just stating the fact. I have class privilege. I walk in Sam's Club. If I want something, I can just get it. That's not how I grew up. But there's a privilege that comes with that class. But there's privilege with any number of statuses in our society. And people freak out when you say privilege because they think you're saying, I didn't earn something. I didn't earn it. You're trying to say that I'm a place I shouldn't be. You're trying to rationalize. Oh, no, what I'm saying is this. There is privilege. Own it and then invest it in helping other people. Does that sound like something Martin Luther King would say? Hello? Yeah, I think it does. If you create a safe space for people to talk, they're going to say things that disappoint you. That's just a fact, and that's okay. Doesn't mean you don't push back. There's a way to push back without crushing people. There's a way to do it. It's not always easy. And then the other part, and I see this again with the whole need to win. I see people all the time engaging in difficult conversations. And what it is they think that if at the end of the conversation, the other person still believes the things that they believe, then I wasted my time by talking to them. It's okay for conversations to be uncomfortable. I mean, I don't seek out uncomfortable conversations. That's kind of masochistic. But it's okay. Last story. This was at Western Michigan University. I went there to give a talk, and one of my ex-students, I used to challenge my students to go out and change the world, right? Mr. Ferris, our founder, for years traveled this country giving a speech called Making the World Better. And for a long time, it was the motto of our school. And now I'm one of the people leading the strategic planning at our institution, and I'm trying to steer us back to this 100-year-old idea from our founder, that we ought to be here not just to make sure that our students can get a job, but that we actually make the world better. Don't hide behind phrases like helping the public good. Don't get into that. Just say what it is, making the world better. I've challenged my students to go out, create their own museums, create their own, and a couple of them have done stuff. So I was giving a talk at Western Michigan, and after it was over, a group of art students wanted us to have a little sit-around talk. Well, I didn't have any of my pieces with me, but one of my students, Khalid El-Hakim, who created the Black History 101 Museum, Mobile Museum, he actually was in the audience, and he had some pieces in his car. And so he went out to his car, and he got three pieces. They weren't especially bad. In other words, he had a doll, which was not heavily caricatured. He had another piece. I don't remember that, but I remember the doll. And so we sat around in a circle, and we just had a simple rule. Everybody talks, no condemnation, and everybody else listens. That's all. And no hitting. And so we passed the doll around, and people would say, somebody would look at it and say, this is a black doll, like a mammy doll. And someone would look at the doll and say, you know, it's just cute. This reminds me of this, that, and the other. Reminds me of time spent with my grandparents. Reminds me, you know, a very nostalgic kind of thing. I'm not saying that in a flippant way. I mean, that's what they said. Someone else talked about the vestiges of slavery and segregation, but we all listened. And it struck me how different it is that you can take two people and they look at the same thing. They hear the same news report. They look at or whatever, and they not only bring with them different things to the object, but they explained it and interpreted it differently. We bring our experiences, fears, expectations to race. I love that. I wish we had videotaped that night, that event. I wish we could, I wish it was kind of a model for the ways you can have some discussions. Productive discourse about race is possible, but it must be honest. It must mean listening to other people.
The image on screen now shows a polluted body of water, with a quote above it from H. Ross Perot. The activist is not the man who says the river is dirty. The activist is the man who cleans the river.
So I don't have a lot in common with H. Ross Perot. I don't know if you remember him. He was like the first billionaire to convince poor people that he had their backs. That seems to be fairly common these days. I like this quote. I don't like the gendered language of it, but I love the message of it. The activist is not the one who says the river is dirty. The activist is the one who does what? Clean the river. I mean, how often it is in this country that we pay, fly somebody in, they come into a place and they tell people everything that's wrong. You're getting screwed. You're getting tattooed. You're getting mistreated. You're getting whatever else. And then they go get on a plane and leave. That's not activism. You know, sometimes people don't like the way we do things in a Jim Crow museum. They think it's too in your face. They think it's too direct, too risky, and that's okay. But I'd be more likely to listen to that criticism if their pant legs were wet. But if your pant legs are dry, then you're just talking. Do something. We are in the early stages of building a sexism museum at Ferris. I guess that one day we'll be your one-stop shop for ignorance.
The image on the screen now shows the words, "If it takes courage to speak in a situation, then there's something wrong with the situation."
So here's an absolute. I love giving absolutes. I love giving absolutes because I'm a sociologist and our training is so relativistic. But here's a thing. I'm gonna make this the most absolute thing you've ever thought about. I don't know, what is there, 7 billion people on this earth, whatever? I haven't been keeping up lately. And the possible interactions between them would be in the, I don't know what the biggest number is. There is no interaction between any humans where it requires courage that's right. In other words, it should never require courage, any situation you're in. You cannot think of a situation where it should require courage, but it often does. I can name 100,000 interactions where it requires courage, and I'm telling you there's something wrong with the situation. It should never require courage.
We'll continue hearing from Dr. David Pilgrim after a short break. Thank you for listening.